The following is a Cartoonerific Studios presentation.
Welcome to Cartoon Fun. It's Cartoonerific. Yeah!
Well, howdy, it's Brian Mitchell, and welcome to the Cartoonerific Podcast, Classic Animated Cartoons. I am your host. Well, today on the podcast, I want to do something a little bit different. You know, normally when we do these shows, we focus on animators and on cartoons, and you know, and we veer off into different directions from time to time. The Disney Company has just hit their 100th anniversary. The company started in 1923 with the Alice in Cartoonland comedies and then eventually got into doing Oswald the Lucky Rabbit in the 1920s. And then around 1928, Mickey Mouse burst on the scene. And really, that was the explosion heard around the world because Mickey became a sensation pretty much overnight. And propelled the Disney company into where it is today. You know, there's been a lot of innovation on the way. You know, Disney ended up going from black and white into color and then refining the process of animation by refining the techniques and training people to get them to do these wonderful films like Snow White and Pinocchio and Bambi. And of course, you know, they got into live action. They got into documentaries. They got into nature films. And eventually they burst on the scene on TV. And so Disney was basically all over the place. It was in merchandising and it was in comic books and record albums. And just at some point, I don't think anybody could really escape that. Somebody has... I would say everybody that's listening to this podcast had something of Disney at a young age. So Disney is very, very important to me. It really helped shape my life. I'm a kid of the 60s, so the 1960s, and I grew up on The Wonderful World of Color, which was a magical show to me. I grew up on these live-action films and the animated films, and you know, I was exposed to the World's Fair, where in 1964-65 they had four attractions. They had It's a Small World. They had the Lincoln exhibit, which was part of the State of Illinois Pavilion. They had the Ford Magic Skyway, and then there was Progress Land, which was a General Electric pavilion that featured the Carousel of Progress. And so those made an impression on me at a young age. And so loving Disney even more, and then everything that Disney came out with, I really embraced. And so very much a Disney kid, very much a Disney adult, still love the theme park, still love all those films. So I felt it was important that we have somebody on here who also loves Disney the way I love Disney and talk a little bit about the company. And talk about the parks and stuff like that. So that's what I mean, that we're going off on a little bit of a tangent, but it's all fun and it's all good. So anyway, the person that I wanted to have on, like I said, basically loves Disney. He loved it so much as a kid that he wanted to work for the company. And after he came out of college, he left New York to go to Burbank, California, and he landed a job with Disney. So he's with us today, and he's a renowned writer of Disney. He's done books. He's written a lot of liner notes. He's done a lot of different things. He's been involved in a lot of things around Disney, and I'm sure you've read or enjoyed some of the stuff that he's done. His name is Mr. Jim Fanning, and Jim will be on to talk about Disney right after this. Please don't go away.
You're listening to the Cartoonerific Podcast, Classic Animated Cartoons, with your host animator, Brian Mitchell. And now it's time for our special Cartoonerific guest.
You know, I knew about this gentleman years ago, and it was out of a fanzine. He had written an article in some magazine, I believe it was Persistence of Vision, years ago, about the Mickey Mouse Club. I believe that's correct. And it was a great article. But he's written a lot of great articles. He's done, if you have any Disney soundtracks on CD, he's written liner notes for that. He's written liner notes for Blu-ray, Disney Blu-ray and DVD. He's written articles for D23 magazine, which is a Disney fan magazine. But it's not just limited to that. He's been involved with so many things over the years. One of my favorite shows was the Disney Family Album, which featured people who were Disney legends, you know, important people at Disney. And they would do like a half an hour talking with these people. And he was involved with that. He is a Disney expert. He's a writer, this historian. He's a wonderful gentleman. And I'm glad that he made time for us today to come on here and talk about all things Disney. So please welcome everybody. Here's Mr. Jim Fanning. Hi, Jim. How are you today?
I'm doing well, Brian. How are you? Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for coming on. It's you know, I have been a fan. I've seen your written material over, I don't know, the last 20 or 30 years. Your name keeps popping up everywhere. It seems like it pops up in magazine articles and on CDs and DVDs and stuff like that. It's amazing. You're all over the place. You are Mr. Disney. So, hey, so glad to have you on here. So, Jim, tell me, how'd you get involved in Disney? What made you?
Well, I think it has so much to do with that. It just is a Disney world, especially for a child.
Yes.
Most children have some experience of Disney. And I was no different, especially since my parents also loved Disney before they had children.
Wow.
But most parents know that Disney's obviously very family friendly and all that. So anyhow, mm-hmm. The fact that I grew up in, you had mentioned that you were from New York.
Yes.
And I'm from New York as well, way upstate near Binghamton in a small town called Vestal. And we lived out in the country. So somehow I think that had something to do with how focused I was, because whenever I was exposed to something Disney, I was like, oh, this is great. And that made me seek out more Disney.
Right.
And then two things happened when I was a small child that really sort of crystallized for me. One of them was in school when we would see educational films. Some of them were pretty dry and not necessarily very interesting. But whenever the film said Walt Disney Presents at the beginning, I would get so excited because I was like, this is going to be good. So it was the standard of quality. And then,
right.
And then the other thing that happened, even as I was really enjoying Disney and anything that I saw, was my friend across the street. She went to a different school and they were having some kind of like bazaar or festival.
Mm-hmm.
So she invited me, and they were showing, as part of the fun for the kids that day, they were showing a film. And she said, oh, let's go. It's Davy Crockett. And I was like, well, I've never heard of Davy Crockett. I don't know what that is, but I know it's a Western. And I wasn't too inclined to Westerns or frontier type stories.
Sure.
Just wasn't my thing.
Right.
But wow, when I saw the movie, which of course was from the TV shows, put together from the Disney TV shows, which I had no idea of.
Right.
I was like, oh my gosh, this was the greatest thing I've ever seen. So Walt Disney can do it all. Everything he does.
Right.
So then that led me, that realization led me to wonder who Walt Disney was. Who right. was this person whose name's on everything and everything he does is so good.
Mm-hmm.
So I started reading about Disney, and I was a great reader. So I loved reading. And you know, I've always loved history. So I loved reading what little there was at the time,
right?
You know, about who the heck Walt Disney was. I even read the Schickel book, you know,
yeah.
which which is a negative thing, but you know, it has some interesting viewpoints. But anyhow, right. I was reading that as a kid.
That's interesting. I have that book somewhere, and it's at the bottom of the heap. But you know, I'm not a big fan of that book.
It's quite negative. But yeah. You know, on the other hand, you know, opposing viewpoints can lead to other thoughts.
Sure.
You can. It's sometimes very, you know, good and healthy to disagree, just to disagree. So at any rate,
I just want to say there were a couple of books that were out there that kind of go into Disney. One was The Art of Animation, which was by Bob Thomas.
Yes.
And we were talking before we actually started doing this, before mm-hmm. the podcast, we're talking about another book, which has been in publication ever since it came out. I got it when I was maybe 13, which was Bob Thomas and American Original.
And I was really excited when that came out, because it was like, oh, great, here's something that tells the whole story.
Yeah.
But we'll get back to that, because I want to talk about Bob Thomas a little bit.
Oh, sure.
Also the whole thing about all the Disney historical books that have come out. But just to finish this part of the story,
sure.
All of this led to me being fascinated with Disney, because reading about Walt mm-hmm. led to reading about all the people that he worked with. And every single one of them is so fascinating. They have their own story. And of course, sure. they're the ones that did create all this under Walt's leadership.
That's right.
So, you know, I was so fascinated, and I was also an artist as a child. That's what I thought I was going to do. Mm-hmm. And I knew I was going to work for Disney in some way. That was my goal.
Right.
But especially, I think, in high school, when I was starting to think about college and, you know, what I would do afterwards, which would be working for Disney, I just came to realize that I didn't think my art skills were up to Disney standards. So then I was like, well, what else could I do? Well, I could write. Mm-hmm. And as I say, I love history, and I also love creating stories. So I was very lucky to be able to, you know, when I did start working for Disney, create both content, as we would say today,
right,
which was storybooks and all kinds of stories and comic books about the characters, mm-hmm. but also write a lot of historical stuff, which is probably, you know, what I'm best known for. I'm sort of branded as a Disney historian. So anyhow, I went from this little tiny town in upstate New York, way out in the country, mm-hmm. to the other extreme of moving 3,000 miles across the country to LA. And wow, what culture shock.
Did you just did you just like one day just say, you know, you're finishing school and you went to college, right? You went to.
Yes. Yes. And even college, I didn't go very far afield. It's practically in my backyard. I went to SUNY Binghamton, which is now called Binghamton University. Right. And it's actually not even in Binghamton. It's in Vestal, which is my tiny little hometown. So right. It's so close to where I lived, it's ridiculous. So I didn't go very far afield.
Right.
But it is an excellent school. My older brother Dave went there. Mm-hmm. And he was very high on it and encouraged me. And also they have an excellent, it's very well known, an excellent cinema department.
Wow.
Where you can take filmmaking or film analysis. Mm-hmm. So I knew I was going to be a writer. So I was like, well, film analysis is writing about film. That's what I want to do.
Right.
So I gravitated toward film analysis. And then, yes, as soon as I graduated, I moved here.
Right.
And
so that was it. You had the graduation, and then it was basically see ya.
Yep.
And
literally. But wow. The thing is, it wasn't just like one day I decided. I'd been deciding that my whole life.
Right.
So I knew I was going to move to California, theoretically Burbank.
Yeah.
So I could work for Disney. And I did. I moved here to Burbank, which is where I have lived ever since.
Right, right.
I've only lived in two towns my whole life.
That's funny.
Lucky for me, because it was vast culture shock. Lucky for me, Burbank is not that small of a town, but it feels like a small town.
Especially
in those days, it was much sleepier. So lucky for me, living here has not been that much of an adjustment. The people are very nice and all that.
Right. Yeah. I used to live in Burbank. I lived on Maple.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, then.
Yeah, North Maple over there. I lived like right in back of the Bewitched House from the Warner Brothers Ranch over there.
Yeah, that's very close to where I live.
Yeah, they're going to be tearing that down soon, I heard.
Yeah, they've already started.
Yeah, they're tearing down the back lot over there. It's going to be no more. So
yeah, so anyhow, I was very lucky. I was very lucky to get a job in the mailroom, and because of that, I did what you're supposed to do. You meet people and you start doing other work, and then at a certain point, I just became a freelancer, writing all kinds of things like documentaries and books and articles, all historical, but also wrote, like I said, stories and comic books about the characters. So I've been very lucky to do it, to kind of do it all.
When you move to Burbank, there's a place over there called Lakeside Apartments, which a lot of people would actually just kind of hole up in for like 6 months and then eventually move. But it was like it seemed to be the place, like if you were going out there, like I know so many animators actually started there.
Oh,
like they went to a hotel and then found themselves there and then eventually moved somewhere else. But that was over. There's actually borderline Toluca Lake over there. But when you moved over there, how long did it take you to get a job at Disney? Was it like almost instantaneous? Wow.
Yeah. And part of the story is that I had actually written to Ron Miller.
Oh.
I actually wrote to him when I graduated from high school.
Wow.
And my parents gave me a trip to California as a graduation present. So he was gracious enough. He said, if you come to California, come see me. And I said, okay, guess what? I'm coming to California and I'm coming to see you.
Did you actually sit with Ron Miller?
I sure did.
Wow. Was he in Walt's office, wasn't he?
Yep. Yep.
He was, of course, none of the decor that was in there. It's all his decor. But
yes, it had been changed, but it was basically the same layout. And once they had moved on from Walt being there, it's a working office and always has been.
Right.
After Ron Miller, until they built the Team Disney building, that's the famous building with the dwarves holding up the...
Yes.
Michael Eisner had that office. And then after
he had Walt's secretary too, didn't he?
Yeah, Lucille Martin, right.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, and Lucille was the person I set up the appointment with both times, both when I graduated from high school and when I graduated from college.
Wow, wow.
And she was, as everybody says, she was so gracious and lovely. She was.
Right.
She was very, very kind.
Wow.
But yes, incredibly, this is something that wouldn't happen today, I assume.
No.
Ron Miller said, yeah, if you want to meet, he must have seen something in me. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I met with him twice. And the second time he gave me a job in the mailroom.
Wow.
Yep.
Well, that's an incredible story, really. Because nobody, it's like if you go to work for like, well, I don't want to say Time Warner, but if you went to work for, let's say, I don't know, Paramount Pictures, they're not going to bring you up to the CEO. You're not going to have access to that. You're going to be, you're going to go to casting or whatever.
Personnel.
Personnel, yeah.
You probably fill out a form and that would be it.
Yeah.
And it's astounding. I mean, even today, if somebody writes to Bob Iger, they're not going to get to see Bob Iger, but Ron directly corresponded with me.
Mm-hmm.
And he said if you ever do come to California, he wasn't assuming I was going to do that,
right?
But he said, come and see me. So I said, okay, And part of the story, for me personally, is that my dad was like, he was very skeptical. He said, "Oh no, he's just saying that. He doesn't think you're really coming, and he doesn't really mean it."
Right.
And you know, and my dad was at that point was in the business world, so you know, he was right in that it would probably most unlikely even in that era.
Yes.
But I don't know. I certainly never asked Ron. I never said, "Hey, why the heck are you seeing me?" I was just glad that he was doing it.
Oh, sure.
But when I said I'm coming, he said, "Okay, come and see me." So we had a really lovely talk. I was fascinated by the Disney TV show and thought they were making a lot of mistakes.
Did you tell him that?
I did. I mean, I didn't put it that way.
Right.
But I said, here are my ideas for improving the show and even improving what you could do with it.
Right.
And he was extremely polite and listened and said he liked some of the ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you need to go to college. And he said, when you graduate from college, come back and see me and right. we'll see what we can do.
Yeah.
So naturally, I was like, okay, I'm coming back as soon as possible.
Right.
And fully expected in my naivete that he would give me a job, which he did.
Yeah.
He gave me a job in the mailroom. He didn't give me a job as, you know, like a producer or something.
You know, a lot of people started in the mailroom. I mean, yeah. I know animators that people that they started in the mailroom, transferred to Disneyland. Ended up back at the studio as an Imagineer. I think, I don't want to say Tony Baxter was in the mailroom, but I know I kind of remember Dave Spafford. I'm going to mention some of these animators that.
Yeah, this was the tail end of that era.
Yeah.
And part of the story is this would not have happened even a few years later. Once Eisner took over and Disney went boom.
Yeah.
You know, just expanded suddenly overnight, which it should have.
Yes.
It was the sleeping giant. It really was. Well, that sleeping giant worked to my advantage.
Yeah.
Because none of this could have possibly happened even a few years later, but it was the tail end of that. And mm-hmm. since the 30s, it had been the system that almost anybody that wanted to work at Disney, especially if they were coming right out of school, they started in the mailroom because the theory was that you would get to know the business.
Yeah.
And like I said, you get to know the people that would potentially give you another job.
Right.
Hired out of the mailroom.
Yes.
So, like, for instance, Disney legend Bernie Mattinson, who I knew and was extremely gracious. We just lost him very recently.
We did. He was an amazing guy. He was another gentleman, another great.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, I can get into that too. But anyhow, yeah. I was just going to use him as an example.
Right.
He started in the mailroom.
Right.
So I was
telling you.
That was very typical.
When we corresponded through email before this, and I mentioned Peter Renaday. And I'm just going to bring this up now because I'm probably not going to remember it later. But he started in the mailroom. He started in traffic. So he kind of found his way in there doing the record album for the Haunted Mansion. And then he ended up, he was the narrator for the Walt Disney Story, which was an attraction at Walt Disney World and at Disneyland. And so he was the narrator for the film. And he just ended up doing so many bit parts in the live action movies. He must be like in 12 Disney motion pictures, live action motion pictures.
Yeah.
Did a voice for the Milkman and Aristocats. And he is all over Disneyland, Walt Disney World.
Yep.
Just this guy. And so I was saying to you, this guy should be a Disney legend because he's basically touched everything with Disney from records to live action animation and the theme parks. And
I agree. Yeah. I agree.
And I hope they give it to him while he's still alive because he's in his 90s. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
that would be really wonderful. Yes. He's a very skilled actor.
Yes.
And you were mentioning his credits. Really just look at anything he does. I mean, even people that kind of know about him,
Right.
They don't know that he's necessarily, they don't necessarily know he's Henry in Country Bear Jamboree.
That's right.
That voice, it's a real characterization.
Yeah.
That is unlike his narration roles and things like that. So right. You really see the actor of the man in that role.
Yeah. And he's Abraham Lincoln.
Well, he was at one point. Yes.
Yeah. They've changed it over the years, but he was. And then a lot of place I know, I worked for Ralph Bakshi on a series called the Mighty Mouse and New Adventures.
Yeah.
And we needed an Abe Lincoln voice, and we went to Pete Renaday.
he could really do anything.
Yeah. When did you first discover Disneyland? Because you discovered Disney through motion pictures, TV show,
yeah,
records, comics. Yeah. I mean, it must have been when you first started working at the studio, I would think, right?
Well, yeah, it's part of my story that being, in New York, in the country, we did not go to any of the Disney parks. I mean, Walt Disney World was pretty new.
Yeah.
And that obviously, I would think, where we would go if we were going, but we didn't go. We hardly went anywhere.
Wow.
We had wonderful vacations, but we would go to the lake in Pennsylvania, you know, Quaker Lake.
Right, right.
That was, you know... That was our big vacation.
Right.
So I knew all along growing up that I wasn't going to go to a Disney park. It just wasn't going to happen. That would have been outlandish for my parents to spend that kind of money.
Right.
So I knew it wasn't going to happen.
Right.
So that's why when people say, oh, some of these Disney TV shows are glorified commercials, I'm like, no, well, perhaps they are. Yeah. But first of all, they're so well done. They're very entertaining. But secondly, they are for people who could not go to the parks.
Yeah.
And I knew that firsthand.
Yeah.
That's how I experienced. So anytime there was a Disney, a show about Disneyland, I ate it up because I wasn't going.
Right.
And this gave me an experience of it. So I did not go to Disneyland until I was an adult.
Right.
Or a Disney park.
Mm-hmm.
Until I lived here. So that's a big part of my story. And it's only in recent years that I've realized that gave me a different perspective.
Sure.
Because it's not about, at least firsthand nostalgia. It's about what it actually is.
Right.
So that really helps me as a writer. Because sure. I'm not writing about, oh, wasn't it fun when I was 4 years old and I went on a flight? And I mean, that's wonderful.
Right.
But I'm now actually grateful for that perspective now that I realize it.
When did you first go? Which was the first park you went to? Was it Disneyland? I want to talk about, because when you went to work for the Disney studios, that must have been crazy on your first day working in the mailroom. And then, so I'm going to backtrack before we talk about Disneyland. When you went to work there, were you just stuck in one place, like in the mailroom, or were you delivering? You were delivering around the lot, right? Were you?
Well, yes, and that again was part of the idea. That mm-hmm. was part of the system, as it were, is that you were exposed to everything. So the way that the mailroom, or as you accurately said, traffic, it was actually called traffic, and I've gotten out of the habit of calling it that because nobody knows what that means,
right?
So I have to say mailroom, but you're right; it was called traffic.
Right.
You were rotated through different routes. There were like, say, 15 different routes.
Right.
So one of them was the animation building, and one of them was the back lot, like the machine shop.
Yeah.
Where, you know, the iWorks family all worked. And, right. you know, there was certainly, you know, the business offices. There was everything.
Yeah.
So if you worked there for probably even 6 months, you had covered the whole lot.
Oh yeah.
And you just kept doing it. So you would get to know people. And hopefully they would give you, you know, you could strike up relationships and they would.
Awesome.
Job.
Yeah.
So yeah, I covered the whole lot. And that's when the back lot was still there. So during lunch, I made friends with some of the young animators like Mike Gabriel and Mike Giamo and
yes,
John Musker and all kinds of these wonderful folks, and they were also also friendly in the Disney mold.
Yes,
they were so down to earth and
Yeah.
They were very friendly toward this little country boy. A mail deliverer. But anyhow, during lunch, we would often go out to the back lot, walk through the Western Street and walk through the Midwest Town Street. And, oh, that was in the Absent-Minded Professor. And that was in, you know, Old Yeller, or not Old Yeller, but one of the Western films anyway.
Right.
So that was all still there.
Did they still have the lagoon back there?
Yeah.
Yeah. I never saw the lagoon. I walked the lot, I think 1981. And I was 18 when I walked the back lot. And
well, you might not have seen it because that was over in the Zorro lot. Sometimes, like for Pete's Dragon, say they added a wharf area with water.
They did,
but the stand and they had a swimming pool for one of the houses. But the lagoon was over by the Zorro. Area which was kind of apart from the rest of the back lot. That's where a parking lot is now, a parking structure, and it's called
the Zorro parking lot. I know. I walked through there not too long ago, and it's all gone.
You yourself and your own career have experienced a lot of this.
Yeah, you know what's interesting about the Disney studio back in I walked in 1981, so I don't know, you had to be around that time too.
And early 80s, right before the Eisner thing happened.
Yeah,
so and we didn't know it was coming to an end.
No, yeah, they still basically the sets for Pete's Dragon, that was all still there. And the Zorro backlot structures were there, but they were starting to raise some of it toward the northern part of the lot, of the backlot. They're starting to raise that. I think they're building a parking garage over there at the time, but most of it was still there, the residential street. And so, yeah, but it was such a small lot. How big is a Disney lot? You know,
it's about 50 acres.
Yeah, it's not that big.
No, so that's why they added all these when they really went into their boom times, which was overnight when Eisner came. They really needed the space.
Right.
I mean, I still disagree with them taking the animators out of the animation building, but they did that because they were bringing all these producers on.
Right.
Live action producers, and they needed office space, and that's the only place where there were offices.
Right.
Their theory was, oh, well, the animators can work anywhere, even though that building was designed for them.
Right. Exactly. They moved them off the lot, I think, what, 86, 87, somewhere around there. And it was sad, but they kept the ink and paint building.
Yes.
They kept that as ink and paint. Yeah.
Which is still there.
Yeah.
But yeah, the big last hurrah before Eisner came in was Something Wicked This Way Comes, when they completely redid at least the small town part of the back lot for that film. Mm-hmm. So that was completely redone. They put a lot of money into it, and they knew it could be used for other films, which it was.
Right.
But Eisner came in right after that. And in fact, he had his kind of town hall meeting on that lot. I was there.
Right.
Like in the gazebo.
Right.
And they crowded everybody back there. And he said, you know, we're not really making changes. We're just going to expand. And that's basically true.
Yeah.
Basically true. Some people of that era still have a bitter taste in their mouth about he did make some changes, but they were really changes that needed to be made. And you cannot argue with success. Certainly we would not have without him agreeing to it. Mm-hmm. We would not have the Disney Renaissance in animation.
That's right.
Because he's the one that authorized the money.
Yeah.
And yes, the animators were working out of trailers in Glendale.
They were. Trailers and warehouses.
Right. It really was more warehouses. But at first it was trailers.
But eventually they moved them across the street. They built a brand new building for them.
Yes, they never did move back into the classic animation building, but yes, you're absolutely right. From scratch, they created a whole new building, and that was all Roy E. Disney.
Yeah.
So, thankfully, and of course, they needed to, with the great success of these, you know, now classic films like The Lion King.
Sure.
You know, that thing was a money machine.
Sure. So, well, they
needed it.
I think starting with Little Mermaid, they just started, it was just one after the other, just made money. And I think with Lion King, when Lion King just made a pot full of money, they kind of look, well, hey, this is where our bread is buttered, so we better. it's sad. I have a thing for backlots, you know, and just seems like they're all being destroyed now. But yeah, it was a sad day when I walked that lot and there was maybe one or two buildings left in the north part of the lot. And that was it. It was all torn down and they put sound stages in its place.
Yes, there's parking lots and office buildings. That's all it is. That's what it's about. Yeah. It's show business, as they say. It's, you know, business.
Absolutely.
So that's what needed to be. But also the industry trend was away from using backlots.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't have the value that they once did. So,
yeah,
you know, it's the location filming. But I think, I can't remember if it was before we started recording or it was in this recording, but you had asked about the Walt Disney offices.
Yes.
And I did have the great pleasure and honor of going there. And that was because of my association with the Walt Disney Archives, which starting with Dave Smith, who was so instrumental in my career because he recommended me. I was a freelancer. He recommended me for so many jobs.
Wow.
That I wouldn't have any way of even knowing about. So he would say, hey, you need this done? Hire Jim.
Yeah.
And they but it's because of my association with the archives that I was able to go visit the Walt Disney offices that have been in recent years restored meticulously and with beautiful accuracy, complete accuracy by the Walt Disney Archives.
Yeah, Dave took a ton of photos. I know basically he went through that place with a fine-tooth comb.
Yes, and he inventoried everything right down to the paper clips in the drawer in the Walt Disney's desk drawer, you know. Wow. Because of course, it wasn't anticipated. Walt's final illness was a relatively few weeks. It was barely, I mean, he went into the hospital for the surgery in October and by mid-December was gone.
Yeah. They expect
astounding short amount of time when you really look at it.
It really was. They said what, 6 months to 2 years that he had, and basically he didn't even last 6 months.
It was a matter of weeks.
Yeah.
And so the office was when he walked out the door on whatever last day that was, they were not anticipating that he'll never be back.
Right.
They thought he was coming back. And then when he didn't, they kept it. They maintained it. And Dave Smith came in 1970.
Right.
And he was put in Walt Disney's offices. And like he said, the only people that had been in those offices since 1966, basically, were the janitorial staff.
Right.
So he made it his first task, really, to inventory and, as you say, record everything that was. So then when it was decided in very recent years that they would restore the offices to the way they were the day Walt walked out of the door for the last time.
Right.
It's 100% accurate.
Yeah. Yeah. I heard they locked up those offices. I mean, it's basically nobody was in there for all that time. I'm sure somebody went in there, but that's what I heard.
I think people do. Sometimes it ends up being more speculation, but they for that time period, yes, from 66 to 70.
Right.
Then, if that's what you mean. But then once Dave Smith had made a record of everything, then they made it back into an actual office, and Ron Miller was in there.
How'd you feel when you went into Walt Disney's office? That'd be kind of like a awe-inspiring event. That would have been something for me, that if I walked into that office now, I think it would be a lot of emotions going through me.
Yes, I think you would have the same type of feeling that I did, because certainly I was excited that I was going. I went with Mike Buckoff, who runs the Disney Photo Library,
right,
and is a good friend of mine. And again, it was my association with the archives. I don't have very many strings to pull.
Mm-hmm.
But, they were gracious enough.
I think you have more strings than I have, though. A lot more strings. Yeah.
Well, could be.
Yeah.
And it depends on your definition, but I certainly not a VIP like some of the people that have gone through the offices.
Right.
But at any rate, the archive staff, like Becky Klein, who's the head of the archives, she had said to me several times, "Oh, Jim, you have to come to see Walt's offices." So at a certain point, Mike said, "Well, I'll take you through." And I was very excited.
Sure.
But when I actually walked into the offices, I was not prepared for the incredible feeling. And I don't know another word except incredible that I had, because it was like a time warp, because it does have the feel, his presence there is tangible.
Yeah.
And it does feel like he just stepped out of the door for a moment and he'll be back, coming back any minute.
Right.
And I really have described it as a religious experience, because that's what it felt like.
Oh, sure. Sure.
It was incredible, incredible experience. And just to see his desk and to see everything that was on it.
Right.
And to be in the same place that, you know, all kinds of stars and all kinds of Disney stars, like the Sherman Brothers, had actually been.
Sure.
It was an incredible, incredible feeling.
Yeah.
And you did get the feeling of Walt as a person, because as Dave Smith always said, by Hollywood standards, this was not the typical movie mogul's office.
That's
where
right.
Guys like Harry Cohen and Louis B. Mayer, their offices were designed to intimidate.
Yeah, they were long hallways with the office, yes, with the actual desk right in front of a window with blinding light coming through.
Yeah, and so. almost like you were approaching a throne.
That's right.
But Walt's offices, and as we said, there were two. There was the formal office where he would meet VIPs and was kind of situated for photo ops.
Mm-hmm.
But his working office is where he was, you know, 90% of the time.
Right.
That's where he would meet with story people and creative people. And he worked at a almost like a coffee table, which was large enough that, you know, six or seven or eight people could sit around it. Maybe not that many, but a group of people could sit around it.
Right.
And they were all equal. It was almost like King Arthur's Round Table,
mm-hmm,
where it was deliberately set up that nobody was at the head of the table. Even the head guy, Walt Disney.
Right.
It was very democratic. And I don't think he ever really thought about it. I think it just reflected who he was. Well, we're going to work, so let's sit down at this table and work. And we're all looking at the same art or the same scripts.
Right.
And having a discussion. So that's all very evident when you're there. You definitely get that feeling.
When you went in there and you felt all this, did you feel, you know, you had to feel a sense of pride, you know, in what you're doing, you know, as far as the,
well,
you know, like the, because you write for the D23 magazine and you write, yes, for everything that's Disney. So you're everywhere, but it must feel good to be doing work for a company and writing about a company that you like so much.
Yes, well, that you articulate that very well. I don't know that I could have put that into words, but I or even thought about doing so. But I agree with you that was part. I guess that was really part of the overwhelming feeling that here was the place, the actual place, not like a set or like a Disneyland where it was on display,
mm-hmm,
but it was the real actual place. He would walk down that hall and, you know, actually be there. You saw where his secretaries were. You saw where people waited to meet with him in the outer offices. I mean, it was the tangible feeling of this man who's a hero to me, but also somebody that I've written so much about and thought so much about. right. and know how central he is, unlike anywhere else.
Yeah.
Disney would not exist without the man, Walt Disney, who actually existed and set all these things, all these storytelling techniques and approaches. He created it all in a, you know, in association with the great people he worked with, but his leadership, none sure. of it would exist. None of it would be.
No.
None of it would be. What would Disney be if he hadn't started Walt Disney World shortly before he died? Yeah. I don't think the Disney company would have done anything like that on their own. He sent the impetus. So everything that is Disney is because of Walt Disney. And yes, you're right. What a connection I felt by being in his office.
Yeah.
It must be why I was so thunderstruck by it.
Yeah. It's electrical. I think his spirit still roams that studio. I think it still roams Disneyland.
Some people do say that. Some people say he actually does haunt the studio.
I've heard that. Have you investigated any of that stuff? Because no, I had a friend. Really. I had a friend that he said they were working there late. They were working in the animation building late, and they heard somebody coughing, and they heard footsteps, and they could not find anybody in the building. It happened a couple of times, and it was like, they just got the heck out of there, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I have heard those stories. I've never looked into it myself, but there are, yes.
There's lots there of them. Are. Disneyland, what is it, the restaurant, the private restaurant over in New Orleans, that's Club 33, and supposedly Walt haunts that place. He haunts his favorite table. So I don't know. Well, you know, he's looking over things, making sure things are being done right. When was the first time you went to Disneyland?
Well, I have an unusual perspective on that, I think, mm-hmm. for a Disney fan.
Yes.
Because, as I said, we lived in a small town in the country, and there was no way that my parents, given their personal situation, were going to be spending money on going to, certainly to California, but even to Florida for Walt Disney World.
Right.
That's probably where we would have gone if we were going, but we didn't. Mm-hmm. And it was made abundantly clear to me as I was probably nagging them.
Right.
Can't we go to a Disney park? Sure. No, we're never doing that.
We're never.
No way we can put you kids through college and everything else and also do that.
Right.
So I had never really been anywhere. We had wonderful vacations. We would go to, we lived right on the border of Pennsylvania. We would go to Quaker Lake.
Right. Right.
And our neighbors had a cottage there. Wonderful. And we would borrow it from them.
Yeah. Pennsylvania is a wonderful place. There's lots of neat stuff in Pennsylvania.
It really is. Yeah. But I mean, we never did anything more than that.
Right.
So therefore, I never went to a Disney park until I was an adult. Mm-hmm. And I went to Disneyland, obviously, because I came here to California as soon as I graduated from college. Boom.
Right.
I came here. So I can't recall if I've said this already or not.
It's all right. I'll figure it out.
Okay. But as in recent years, I realized that unique perspective has given me a good stance as a historian, because I'm not thinking about nostalgia. I'm thinking about what it actually is and how it was created.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with that nostalgia, but mm-hmm. I'm now grateful for the unique perspective that has given me over the years.
Right. Interesting. I remember watching, you know, I remember watching the Disney TV show back in the 60s. And they would occasionally do a show like Disneyland Around the Seasons, or they'd do Disneyland. Well, I wasn't alive for this, but I saw it later, Disneyland 59, which was an excellent show, really. Uh-huh. And it kind of gave you a flavor. There was a show after Walt Disney passed away where it features footage of Walt, where they talk about all the new stuff in Tomorrowland, because Tomorrowland was being revamped. And so they talk about that stuff, and they talk about Pirates of the Caribbean, or Caribbean, some people like to say it.
Okay.
But yeah, but that show was very, very interesting because you see the joy of Walt Disney. He seems like he's really enthused. And I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it was kind of like made up for the camera. I think he just really was happy to be talking about this stuff, you know, the this new attraction that's going to be in New Orleans Square in Disneyland. So that
yes, really captures his natural enthusiasm.
Yeah. When you first went to Disneyland, was it like, wow, I can't believe I'm going? And then
yeah. Oh yeah.
So what was the feeling like going there? Can you tell us how you felt like when you went through? Because it had to be when you're into Disney for all this time, then now you're working for the Disney studio, and now you're going to step foot into this park that Walt Disney lavished so much love on. And basically all the animators and the set decorators, everybody that was creative was involved with making this special place. How'd you feel going through the gate?
Well, in a way, almost like it was for when I went into Walt's office. I was just so excited and so, I mean, I had longed to be there my whole life.
Right.
And by then, of course, I had read so much about it. So.
And as an employee, you didn't have to pay to get in, I would imagine. I think that.
Well, how do you know Disney? Come on now, Brian. No, you're right. We did get a certain, I mean, I certainly didn't have a silver pass as right. A person in the mailroom.
Right.
But they did give us free tickets, a certain amount every year.
Right.
So yeah, I had a free ticket, and Lucille Martin, Ron Miller's secretary, was very gracious and kind.
Right.
So probably I went on the tickets she gave me.
Ah, I see.
I hadn't been an employee very long when I went. Believe me, I went the first chance I got.
Right.
So at any rate,
how long after you started at Disney? Was it a couple of weeks, or how long did you wait before you actually went? Do you remember?
Probably a month.
A month, yeah. That sounds right. Because yeah, you got to get settled, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I came to California. I met with Ron Miller. He gave me a job in the mailroom. And then I had to find a place to live because I was staying in a hotel.
Right.
Can't do that very long.
Right.
With no money.
Right.
I mean, I had no money.
Right.
So.
Right. And transportation, so I'd imagine.
I rented a car.
Yeah.
I rented a car because it was like a year, if not more, before I had a car.
Wow.
But I lived in Burbank, so it was easy to get to work. It was easy to get to the Disney studio.
Sure.
Because I just took the bus.
Right.
So, yeah. But to get there, yes, I literally rented a car. Wow. So, yeah. I went as soon as I absolutely could because, oh, are you kidding?
Yeah.
I'm just a relative few miles from there now. So I had to go as soon as I could. But yes, you're right. The feeling was incredible. The feeling was incredible. And of course, the very first thing I did was I rode the Disneyland Railroad, Walt's Pride and Joy, and then I saw the Walt Disney Story, of course.
Right. There you go. Wow.
Well, and I took a funny approach and nobody could believe it. And I was teased because of it, but I went on no attractions.
No.
I just wanted to walk around.
And just breathe it in. Wow.
Because of course I knew I was coming back. If that was the only, like my one shot, that would have been different, but I knew I was coming back.
Well, you did do the Walt Disney Story and you did the railroad. Yeah. And
those are attractions. You're right.
Yeah.
But I did do Space Mountain. I didn't do Big Thunder Mountain.
Haunted Mansion.
Yeah. Yeah. No, right.
Right.
Exactly.
Wow.
Because I just wanted, to your point, mm-hmm. I wanted to experience the park, the environment, and the atmosphere.
Right.
I went on attractions the next time I went.
Right.
And I also went alone.
That's interesting.
First of all, I didn't really have any friends.
Right.
I didn't know anybody.
So the first time you went alone, the second time, did you go with somebody?
Yeah, I went with a friend the second time. So yeah. then it was great fun to go on all the attractions.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, but that was deliberate. I said to myself, the first time I'm going, I just want to look. I just want to see everything, because as we all know, the atmosphere and the environment is as important as anything at a Disney park.
There is something to be said for just sitting on Main Street on a bench, just taking it all in.
Absolutely.
And it's the same thing with every single land in the park. Some of the most memorable times for me at a Disney park is in the evening where the lights come up and, you know, maybe just grabbing a cup of coffee or sitting on a bench and just kind of enjoying the sights, sounds, the smells, of the park. It's so detailed.
Yes, and, absolutely. It's so immersive.
Yeah. So
yeah, I totally agree.
I know people that just go there and they just like to hang out. They just like to hang out. They just, because generally people are happy, it makes them feel good, you know? And it's,
And that was part of the original, at least the original idea.
Right.
Is that Walt wanted it to be a place of beauty that you could just go and you didn't have to rush around and wait on lines necessarily. You could just go and enjoy. And I think that was part of the original ticket system. I mean, there was more involved than that.
Right.
But you could buy a ticket to Disneyland inexpensively because it did not include anything.
Right.
Now it's been decades of the passport where you buy one ticket and it's everything's included.
Right.
So that is
for $1 million.
Yeah,
no, it's not quite. It's not quite that much.
No. Yeah, you have to mortgage your house. but that's one when people say, "Oh, it used to be so inexpensive. Now it's so expensive." Well, it didn't used to include anything, though. You had to buy separate tickets.
Exactly.
So part of it was that somebody could decide, "Oh, let's go to Disneyland. We'll go and have a nice lunch, and we'll just relax and just enjoy. Look at the flowers and the plants, and look at the parade, and see, hear some music." And you could just hang out, and then you didn't have to buy tickets to go on, you know, the railroad or.
No, it was just a general admission ticket.
Yeah.
And then there were, I know in Disney World, they had a couple of free attractions, things that you could just, it was part of the admission and there was no ticket needed.
Right. And sometimes when modern day people look back at those tickets that they see at, like on eBay, or they see online, like something I might show on my YouTube channel or whatever, or write about.
Right.
They see that it says, you know, this attraction's free. And they're like, well, what does that mean? Because everything's free in the sense that it's included in the admission, but didn't used to be that way.
No. And it was tiered. So you had A, B, C, D, and E tickets.
The famous E ticket. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't think it was always E. I think it went up to D, didn't it? And then
they added the E in 1959
with the Matterhorn.
Yeah, with the addition of those big, with that, you know, Disneyland second opening day, as they call it.
Yeah.
That's when they added the e-ticket. So you're right. Not right away.
Yeah.
But it was so long ago now when I first went that it wasn't like I was spending $1 million and then just walked around.
Right.
I bought, it was a free ticket anyhow, but I admission ticket.
Right.
So, you know, you would still have to buy the separate tickets, but it didn't matter. I just wanted to experience it. And still today, especially since I've been so many times and written about it so many times, like the last time I went was in December. That was my first visit since the pandemic.
Right.
Well, it was almost like my first visit. I didn't stand on any lines. I didn't, you know, go on, you know, the big E ticket attractions. I really just walked around.
Just taking it in again.
And enjoyed it and took it all in, yeah.
Yeah, just appreciating it.
Yeah.
It's pretty neat. Have you been to all the Disney parks now, or?
No, that's a great question. I've been to Disneyland, Walt Disney World, and Tokyo Disneyland.
Wow, okay. I heard Tokyo Disney Sea is pretty amazing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it is an absolutely extraordinary park. It is so different from anything else, completely unique.
Right.
Absolutely stunning. That I'm very, very happy that I got to experience that. What I equate it with is Disney's Animal Kingdom. Right. Because, again, completely unique. There's nothing like it at any other park.
Yeah. It's turned out to be a really great park, Disney Animal Kingdom in Florida. It started off not so great because there was a couple of shows. It was well designed, but it was just not a whole lot to do. I mean, basically, it was a zoo. But now it's changing now. There's some great stuff in there.
Disney's Animal Kingdom. I think it's one of the best. And also one thing I love about it is that I think Walt Disney would have loved it with his great love of animals and his great love of nature.
Yes.
I think he would have loved it. And of course he did want live animals at Disneyland and it was just not feasible.
Yeah. That was going to be at the Jungle Cruise.
Yeah.
And at the Tiki room until they realized, the parrots are going to be pooping in the food because they were going to serve food there. Correct.
Well, I don't think they ever were really going to do real birds, but
right.
They were afraid people were going to be thinking about that.
Yeah, sure.
But at any rate, he did want real animals, and given his great love of animals, of course. So they figured out a way to do that at Disney's Animal Kingdom, which is absolutely amazing and astonishing.
What's your favorite land at Disneyland?
My favorite land at Disneyland is Main Street USA and Fantasyland, probably because those are so reflective of Walt.
Yeah.
And I saw Fantasyland in its original form.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Before the big renovation where they ripped it all down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I loved what they did. They of course, it's been that way ever since, which is a long time now.
Yeah.
I loved what they did. And boy, did they commit. They spent a lot of money on completely redoing Fantasyland.
That was Tony Baxter's deal, wasn't it?
He's certainly one of the leaders on it for sure.
Yeah, he was an amazing talent. It's surprising that he retired already. You know, you think these people are going to be around forever. You know, I mean, he's around. It's just he did his thing, and he was so influential on so many different things, especially in Florida with the Figment attraction, the original one, anyway. That was so good. He was basically the leadoff on Splash Mountain. I think he designed that, didn't he?
And, he was a big creative force on that as well.
Yeah, amazing.
So was Bruce Gordon. Tony Baxter was one of those, of course, who always planned on being an Imagineer.
Right.
He jumped at having some kind of job at Disneyland.
Right.
He was still there when Walt. He was there when Walt was alive.
Yeah.
He even had Walt come by and get an ice cream cone from him.
Wow. Wow, pretty neat. What are you working on now? You have stuff coming out. You have a YouTube channel, don't you?
I do have a YouTube channel. Now it's we're just now celebrating 3 years, but I still consider it very new. And once a week on every Tuesday, I premiere a new video, and it's kind of focused on works. I'm expanding a little bit beyond it now, but I had to have if I'm going to do a video every week,
right?
In addition to all these other jobs,
sure.
I had to have a way to do it. So the way, you know, just kind of sit down and be able to do it without a lot of planning, because I don't have time for that.
Sure.
But I show things from my collection, and I don't have a huge collection by Disney collector's standards.
Right.
To the layman, I might have a lot of stuff, but you and I both know people that have tons and tons of collectibles, and you're a collector yourself.
Yeah, unfortunately. it kind of eats up the cash real quick.
Yeah, it can. So it's a way for me to talk about Disney history, but at the same time show something interesting to the camera.
Right.
So that's sort of the idea behind it. Right. And it's called Toldywood TV. And if anybody would like to see the videos, and I hope they will, I hope they will go to YouTube. You can just search Toldywood TV. You can search Jim Fanning. You can search Jim Fanning Disney. Any of it will.
And it will come up.
Yeah.
How do you spell it? It's T-U-L-G-E-Y, right?
That's correct. Okay. Yep.
So, yep. Yeah. So
the drawback to that name that people don't know what it is or how to spell it or anything. Just search my name. And...
Right. We'll put a link on the website.
Thanks.
Do you have any questions or comments about the podcast? Please email Brian at cartoonerific.com. Your email may be featured in one of our future shows.
Well, wasn't that something? That's Jim Fanning. And it's actually a two-part interview. I know it kind of sounds like it's, we're finishing up, but we're not. We actually go into more stuff talking about Disney. So this is a two-parter. Jim will be back next week for part two. Stay tuned for that. You don't want to miss it. Well, I have to say, I've been enjoying doing these interviews, and I hope you're enjoying them too. If you have any comments, please send them to me. It could be a suggestion or a comment, a suggestion for maybe a guest or a show topic. Send it to me at brian@cartoonerific.com. I do look at them, and I do respond. So please send those comments along. If you really like what you're listening to, please subscribe. All you have to do is go to that service that provides our podcast, click the subscribe button, and you will be notified every time a Cartoonerific podcast is uploaded for your listening pleasure. Also, if you really like what you're listening to, tell a friend about us. Call up somebody. Say, that Cartoonerific podcast thing, it's okay. Try to be a little bit more enthusiastic, though. Anyway, I want everybody to have a great day. I want you to have an excellent week, and thank you all once again for tuning in.
This has been a Cartoonerific Studios presentation.
The Cartoonerific podcast is copyright 2024 by Cartoonerific Studios Incorporated. All rights reserved.